Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
And good afternoon from Florida Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the October 30th, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Well, on a day when it seems all of Central Florida may be gathering along the beach for a big air show this afternoon, the Thunderbird's set to fly in about an hour from now if their schedule is maintaining. We've got a lot of talk about here today on the show, so let's get right to it. If you've missed the news today so far or just tuning in here, you may not know yet that the launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery on its final mission into orbit has been pushed back now to Wednesday. And to help us explain what's happening out at the launch pad, NASA's George Diller, the voice of shuttle launch control for this particular shot, does join us today by phone from the Kennedy Space Center. Good afternoon, George. How you doing?
Hi, Jim.
Well, look, it looks like things anyway are well in hand at the launch pad. It seems like all your problems are solved, but you just need a little bit more time to get everything done. Is that the case? Talk about it.
Well, for the most part, it's a little bit like you start out to work on your car. You got a project that you want to do, and you start taking it apart, and you get things out, and you get into it and discover that the job is more than you thought it was. It's going to take longer because there's more things. All of a sudden, you get into it, you realize you got to do.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way this turned out after we got in there and started removing or replacing these components that contain the seals that were leaking. This changeout work turned out to take more time than we thought because there was more to it than we thought. So now we've got that largely done, and the components are back in. And today we're back in repressurizing some of the systems and also doing some retest. So if you took the schedule and came out to where it should end, it just didn't get to a launch on Tuesday. So in a way, it's kind of good because it still gives us now a little bit of a contingency to make Wednesday if everything continues to go well. And Wednesday, the weather gets a little better as well. So it's probably going to work out just fine. And you know, I know there are a lot of folks locally, including the launch team, that were worried about Tuesday with the combination of voting and the air show activity and everything that was going on. It would have been quite a challenge for the folks in North Brevard, particularly law enforcement and local leaders, to be able to deal with it all. So, you know, there are little silver linings in the slip. I mean, would have rather launched on time, of course, but you play the cards you're dealt, and we're dealt Wednesday.
Yeah, and you know, your NASA test director this morning was asked if there was relief that it had moved off of Tuesday, and he said the right things. I'm telling you, I woke up in a big relief because I didn't have to go running out to vote this afternoon,
get caught in. I was planning to vote on Tuesday. I'm a traditionalist. I like to go to the polls on voting day.
You talk to the nice vote, volunteers, and you get your sticker and the whole nine yards.
Yeah,
you know?
I would have had to vote it today early as well. So that
worked out pretty well. Now, as far as technical problems go, as I read this with my experience, it was not that, quote-unquote, big of a deal as far as technical problems. It was something you've handled before. But it was one of those things where it just kind of happened at the wrong time. I mean, this could have happened 100 times in the history of the program. We've never heard about it. But because it affected a launch and all the world is gathered here, suddenly it's the most important thing in the world.
Well, this pressurization occurs fairly late in the processing flow as you're getting ready to launch for a combination of reasons. But once you do that test, when you pressurize, if you've got a problem, then you probably are not going to have enough time to recover if we have to do the kind of work that we had to do and still make the launch date.
Now, you know, they were talking about the weather. Kathy Winters gave you a 70% chance to go, and I like the way that the winds were coming around to line up with the runway. A lot of questions about what may now be Hurricane Tomas. That's way out there, though. Not going to be an impact at all, it doesn't look like.
Doesn't appear so. I think Tomas is going to take care of itself. I think the only thing we might watch a little bit is the conditions for the solid rocket booster retrieval ships, but they are still well within their limits to do the booster retrieval as opposed to having to just stand by and wait for the seas to calm down. So they're still pressing ahead with a plan to recover right after launch.
Yeah, and the concern there, of course, you know, you're launching to the north. The ships would be out to the north, basically east of, I think, what, Daytona or Jacksonville?
Jacksonville usually is,
more like
is
Jacksonville.
Their station, about 140 miles to the northeast of Cape Canaveral.
So the effects of this storm isn't that it's moving this way and going to dump all sorts of stuff on us. It's the way that it churns up the ocean and makes the waves more difficult to work out there.
Just makes the swells a little higher. And it's easier to recover, especially for the divers, if you don't have the thing bobbing up and down like a cork when you're down underwater trying to put the diver's plug in there so you can dewater it. But I think right now they feel like it's not really going to be much of an issue at all.
So take us now really quickly through the countdown officially begins tomorrow and leads you to what kind of a launch window on Wednesday?
Well, the plan right now is to pick up tomorrow at 2 o'clock with the countdown, and that'll get us to a launch on Wednesday afternoon, and we'll go into the final built-in hole where we'll adjust the launch window a little bit, but that should take us to a 3:52 launch time Wednesday afternoon. 3:52:13 to be exact would appear to be the sweet spot in there in the middle of our 10-minute window, and that'll take us off on an 11-day mission that would get us back to the Cape at just before 10 a.m. on the 14th, Sunday the 14th of November.
And do you have a little flexibility in this launch time? I mean, you've got the 10 minutes. Because of the flight day 3, flight day 4 issues about when you can dock with the space station, you have a little bit more time, like 3 minutes or something?
Yeah,
like that.
I believe we came out with just under 3 minutes of additional time.
Well,
that helps because, you know, with these space station launch windows, you don't have much time to deal with any issues, so we'll take any additional minutes we can get.
Absolutely. Now, going into this mission, we all know this is the last launch of Discovery, and again, for those folks out at the Space Center who work with these vehicles and treat them like their own, like they're parts of the family, you know, we've been asking folks what do they think about the last flight. You know, George, you called a whole bunch of Discovery launches. The window on the universe, Hubble, was one of your most famous ones. What's your heart telling you right now as you go into this countdown, get ready to call the launch on Wednesday?
Well, I kind of see it as significant in terms of if you look back at the history of Discovery, it's probably had more things that are of significance in the space shuttle program than just about any other orbiter. You know, it launched the Hubble, as you said. It was the first flight of a Russian cosmonaut on the shuttle. It was the first time we rendezvoused with Mir, was on Discovery, the Russian Mir space station. It was the highest altitude we ever flew on a space shuttle flight. It did the final shuttle Mir docking. It did return to flight after both the Challenger and Columbia accidents. So it's just there's so many things. I mean, and that's just a start. I mean, there's just a whole list of things that Discovery has done. So if you want to look back on the history, when the whole program is over next year sometime, if you look back on the history the shuttle program has had, you're going to find that Discovery was a part of so much of that it did so many of these things that made the shuttle program the storied program that it is.
Well, George, thanks. So we're going to run out of time here. Thanks for those comments. Good luck. Best wishes to you and the entire launch team. We'll be keeping track, okay?
Thanks very much.
Thanks,
Wednesday
George.
It is.
Okay, well, of course, stay tuned to WMMB throughout the week for updates on the countdown. You can also visit the Space Talk webpage at WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. For updates from me and exclusive photos, by the way, of the countdown and launch provided by photojournalist Mark Uziak, who's going to work with us on the launch this week. Our live coverage of the launch will begin after the news at 3 o'clock on Wednesday. And let's see, we'll take a quick break now. We'll be back and talk about Mars on this holiday weekend. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Banky.
And welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. A reminder that our phone lines are open at 321-768-1240 for your questions and comments about anything having to do with the space program. Our local AT&T wireless customers can dial *1240 for a free phone call right here into the studio, or you can contact us via email. The address is spacetalking@aol.com. Of course, throughout the week, we invite you to come visit the webpage, WMMBAM.com, for all sorts of goodies there. You can download a podcast of today's program, and you can find out what's going on with the show. And again, as we said at the top of the hour, we'll be following the launch of Discovery, the final launch, a lot closer this week, trying to get you some updates. And our good friend Mark Uziak, a longtime photojournalist, is working with us on this particular launch to provide some very exclusive behind-the-scenes images of this countdown launch. We've got some great shots of the crew arriving. We're going to post on the website here in the next day or so, and then we'll follow up with some pictures of Discovery out at the launch pad, certainly the night before launch, and then of the liftoff. Mark, in fact, is going to be on the roof of the vehicle assembly building taking pictures for us. And we're going to get those posted online for everyone to enjoy as we celebrate this final flight of Discovery from the Kennedy Space Center. We're standing by here to talk with planetary scientist Ashwin Vizavada from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And as sometimes is the case, we're having delays in getting a hold of him. We're working on it right now. So in the meantime, we'll move on to some other discussion. I want to let you know some things that have been going on this week in space and throw in some commentary here a little bit. You know, we have we talk about spaceflight and about how hard it is, how difficult it is, the risks that are involved. And too often and too easily, I think, we become, you know, so smug in our confidence and in the ability to do what we do, that I think we need a wake-up call every once in a while. And we don't want it, but sometimes it happens, and it's forced upon us. And a perfect example of that, unfortunately, happened this past week. You may not have heard about it, but I think everyone in the space community ought to be aware of it. And if you're not a part of the space industry, you ought to know that this stuff still happens after all these years. It was on Thursday night that an Ariane 5 rocket launched from the Guyana Space Center in South America. The space center there next to the city of Kourou in French Guyana. It is the Ariane 5 is the European, basically the European Space Agency, not so much the agency as Europe's commercial space launcher, has been in competition with us in the United States. And going back to the beginning of the shuttle program, it used to be just Ariane versus shuttle. And in fact, I wrote a paper when I was at school at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University up in Daytona Beach. I wrote a paper back in, this must have been 1983, 84, something like that, about the competition between Ariane and the shuttle. Because the shuttle at that time was, and I'm digressing here in part just to fill time here as we try to get a hold of Ashwin, because the shuttle, everything that we were launching into space at that time was on board the shuttle. The national space policy decision was to dump everything on shuttle so that you had a reason to fly it. And again, the promise back then, of course, was that we'd be up to 10, 15, 24, 30 flights a year. In fact, some of the charts that came out even before the shuttle first flew was promoting this idea that the space shuttle would fly a space shuttle would fly as many as 52 times a year. There's this chart. It's buried in a bucket of mine in the garage somewhere. Someday I got to find it and post it. That actually showed the processing of the shuttle. Now remember, this was long before we actually had the experience This was probably in the 1978-79 time frame, where you had the idea that the space shuttle would launch from the Kennedy Space Center. So that's the start of the clock. And you would fly, let's say, a 3 or 4 day mission. You would deploy your satellites. You'd come back and land. So let's say a week has passed. You would be towed within the day, even in a few hours, back into its hangar. You'd spend basically a week in the hangar, another week or so in the vehicle assembly building, and then another maybe a week or two out at the launch pad. And within basically a month, you would have that vehicle turned around from the runway back out onto the launch pad, and away you'd go again, and you'd fly again. And with several orbiters, such as Columbia and Challenger and Discovery and Atlantis at the time, you could do a turnaround where everything's constantly going and put out basically a flight a week. And some of them would be quick satellite delivery missions, and some of them would be long-term space science laboratories with the space lab and eventually hopefully building a space station as well. And so you'd have all this activity going. You know, in fact, there was Pad A, there was Pad B for a short time. The thought was that there might even need to be a Pad C as you keep flying these things. And so in the meantime, by the way, because we're flying everything on space shuttle, we don't need the Atlas and the Delta rockets anymore. And so we lost the Atlas and the Delta. We shut down our capability to build and fly these expendable launch vehicles. And the pads at the Cape started deteriorating. The Eastern Range, in certain circumstances, for certain capabilities, lost certain capabilities. And so the whole thing just kind of eroded and went away. Well then, so now you come back to the shuttle, and Ariane starts launching from South America and charges less money for carrying commercial satellites than what the government was going to charge for flying on the shuttle. And I wrote a paper that compared the two, and clearly Ariane was cheaper. And, of course, then you'd start throwing accusations of government subsidies and back and forth and the politics and all of that. So anyway, after all these years, Ariane's been a tremendous success, grabbed the world's share of the market, and launched this satellite into orbit on Thursday night. It was Eutelsat W3B, a commercial communications satellite. It was successfully injected into its orbit, a geosynchronous transfer orbit. So it's at a certain orbit where then once it's clear of the rocket, it would use its own propulsion system to fly to its final orbit, 22,300 miles above the equator. And so that happened Thursday night. Friday morning, Eutelsat announces that it had experienced a major propellant leak and would not be able to reach its final orbit. So something very bad happened on the satellite. The company declared it a complete failure, and they're now working to safely dump it back into Earth's atmosphere where it's going to burn up. Of course, the finger-pointing for the blame has already begun. There's folks claiming that the propellant tank was damaged at the pad before launch. And to me, it doesn't matter. I think the point here that I'd like to make is that I think that it's a reminder, you know, once again, that even though we as an entire global aerospace industry have all this experience built up in doing something, you know, as supposedly routine as launching commercial communication satellites into Earth orbit, you know, that accidents still do happen. Failures do occur. And I think that that's a lesson that we still need to learn, that even though it looks so routine and we hate using that word, routine, things like this still happen. And it's a reminder to stay vigilant, stay on top of things, and be very careful about your plans and your preparations for every launch. Okay, well, that said, we do have Ashwan Vazavada from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory with us now from Pasadena. And by way of introduction, and Ashwan, I'm not sure how much we'll get to chat before we take our break here, but I do want to introduce this by saying that tomorrow is Halloween. And, you know, it's a big day in the kid year. It's another step toward Christmas. Big day for me. Looking forward to the trick-or-treating and all that. And one of the things that's always been fun in Halloween for me is to listen to the old Orson Welles radio broadcast of War of the Worlds, dating back to that radio broadcast that scared everybody, that thinking we were going to have an alien invasion of Mars. That broadcast actually took place on this very date, October 30th, back in 1938. So I've had Mars on the brain. I thought what a great day to do an update on Mars. And so joining us by phone very briefly, and then we'll take a break and come back with him, from Pasadena is Dr. Ashwin Vazavada from the NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He is the deputy project scientist for the next big probe that we plan to send up there, the Mars Science Laboratory, which also goes by the name of Curiosity. So, Ashwin, welcome to Space Talk. Glad to have you on board, sir.
Yeah, great to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, and I know we had a little trouble getting a hold of you at first, so that's okay. We filled some time. We've got about another minute or so before we got to take our first our break at the bottom of the hour. Give us the 45-second game show biography about yourself. Tell us about yourself and how you wound up in the space program.
Okay. Well, I was born in this country and grew up, you know, watching NOVA and all those other programs that were wonderful and showed us, you know, getting to Mars for the first time and flying by Jupiter with Voyager. And I just became fascinated with the planets, even as a little kid. And it wasn't so much wanting to be an astronaut. It really was studying the planets. And so tried to figure out how to do that in college and finally found the right way and the right major and got the right, you know, job to start out with. And now here I am helping send the next big rover to Mars.
Oh, that's great. Well, with that little tease there, we're going to take our five-minute built-in hold, get everyone caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. When we return, more about the exploration of Mars, your questions and comments also. And remind you, this is Space Talk, brought to you weekly here by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
This is Space Talk with Jim Banky.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Okay, time to raise the hand on the foul here. I just spent the last segment talking about routine things going wrong and that we all need reminders. And while I'm explaining this to everybody and making this profound point, my own error was evident here as my chief engineer, Aaron Michaels, was trying to get a hold of Ashwin. I wrote down the wrong area code, so I will raise the foul on that. And it was my fault. It was correct on my paper. And I wrote it down on the note wrong to Aaron, and, you know, I could blame the new reading glasses I'm wearing, I could blame the age, I could blame my profound excitement over the Vikings playing the Patriots tomorrow, but I made a mistake, and we had to pay for it, and there you go. So, you know, God works in mysterious ways. He just decided to smite me during the last segment. Well, we put that behind us now. Go back to the phone with our guest, Ashwin Vazavada, from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, also the home of the Rose Bowl and a few little old ladies who like to drive recklessly. I'm sure Ashwin has to watch out for him as he goes to work. Ashwin, you in the first part there with your little tease answer there, you talked about that the planets interested you. I want to let you expand a little bit upon that because, when I was a journalist and covered the Voyager 2 encounter of Neptune, I think that was one of the highlights. It's in the top five of the biggest things that I've ever done in my life was to sit there that night in August of 89 and watch these pictures, these first pictures come back of Neptune and the thrill of exploration that was. Is that the same kind of thing that resonates with you, why this all fascinates you and you've dedicated your life to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're privileged to be living in this time when we're the first people in the human race to be able to look at these other worlds that are really just right next door to us. I think what's so fascinating about it to me is that these are, especially the more we study them, we realize that their entire worlds, they're not just points in the sky, but they're entire planets, and they have so much to fascinate us about them. And there's so many different kinds. You know, there's Mars, which is a very Earth-like planet. And then there are the gas giants, which are 11 times the size of Earth, and have storms that are as big as the entire planet. You know, and all those things are just so fascinating in many different ways.
A lot of people ask the standard question about, why study the other planets and what the benefits are beyond just fulfilling our own sense of spirit, our own sense of wonder, which I think, by the way, is just enough. But, when you're asked that question, as I am doing now, how do you respond to that? What's the reason we do this?
I think one of the reasons we have such a commitment to it is because there are several big reasons. As a scientist, I'll say it's because I want to understand how geology and atmospheric science, you know, weather, all those things, by studying them on other planets, we can just learn about those subjects in general and apply it right back to Earth. But beyond the science, there's just the almost the philosophical point of view where we want to understand the world around us. You know, it'd be one of the biggest things humanity could ever determine is if we are alone in the universe or not. And we start that by just exploring our neighbor planets, because that's what we have the easiest access to for now.
Yeah, and Mars, of course, being so close and so like us, and so that kind of sets us up for what you're working on now. I know that you've done some work with the Galileo at Jupiter, Cassini at Saturn. I think you said that you studied you know, some of the climate and weather patterns and whatnot at Mercury, polar ice at the Moon, and all of that. You know, what's the next thing about Mars? What do we need to learn about Mars yet? And how is what you're working on with the Mars Science Laboratory or Curiosity going to address those kind of things?
Yeah, you know, I've had the privilege of looking at all these different planets over over the past 20 years or so, and but you know, as much as I love those other planets, Mars is almost a first among equals in the sense that it has the greatest promise for having had life at some point in the past or even today. And so, you know, one of the goals of our rover mission, Curiosity, is to determine whether Mars was ever a habitable planet. We think it was. We're really not sure if there ever life was life or life was able to take hold, but we're going to look for clues to whether it was a friendly place, even in its distant past or today.
And how far back do we have to look, or do we think we have to look?
Yeah, this is kind of fascinating. You know, if you look at Earth's history, it was pretty hazardous to life when it started out, you know, 4 billion years ago. There was all kinds of impacts going on, volcanoes, the atmosphere hadn't got oxygen in it yet. Mars almost has a reverse story, where we think the most likely time where life could have found a friendly environment was in its very earliest history. And so, you know, with our rover mission, we're specifically looking at landing sites that would give us access to a geologic record of this earliest part of Mars history.
You know, you talk about, especially as we talk about planets being discovered around other stars, which, again, the fact that we're even able to do that now just boggles the mind.
Yeah.
And that, what's it called, the zone, not the comfort zone, the habitable zone. Yeah, you know, and you think we're in our own solar system. You've got Venus on the one end extreme, you got Mars on the other, and Earth smack dab in the middle.
That's right.
So Mars is on the far end. I grew up thinking that if there were, or being taught, I guess, or believing that if there ever was life in an atmosphere on there, that it all escaped because Mars' gravity wasn't strong enough to hold it. And I have no idea if that's still the theory or not, you know, if it was habitable, as part of Curiosity's mission to figure out why it's not anymore?
There's actually another mission called MAVEN that's coming up, an orbiter mission that's going to be looking at that. In addition to the gravity, it's the fact that Mars, because of its size, it cooled down more quickly and lost the liquid interior that helps drive a magnetic field on Earth.
Okay.
You know, the magnetic field is what shields us from the effect of the sun, which tends to strip away atmospheres and that's what happened to Mars. Mars lost most of its atmosphere that protected what used to be a much bigger atmosphere and more wet and more warm planet.
Let's spend some moments here on Curiosity itself as a piece of hardware, and compare it to the rovers that we've all come to know and love, Spirit and Opportunity. This thing is like the Wagon Queen family truckster, isn't it? Compared to the little, you know, Spirit and Opportunity.
Yeah, it's a big thing. It's about the size, it has the wheelbase of like a Hummer.
Wow.
It's a little bit smaller in volume, but the big deal about Curiosity is that it finally gives us a chance to fly real laboratory-quality instruments to Mars. You know, in the past, we've sent little small rovers, and then now these rovers that are currently operating are a fairly good size. There's kind of a golf cart size rovers. And they're still limited to driving around, taking pictures, and maybe sniffing around at the surfaces of the soil and rocks. With Curiosity, we're taking a jackhammer drill to really dig into the rocks and soils, acquire samples, and then put them in these really sophisticated chemical laboratories, which are located inside the rover itself.
Hmm.
And that's the kind of experiments we need to do to figure out whether the environment in the distant past and even today gives a promise for, you know, would have been a friendly place for life to take hold, would have given it the materials it needs to take hold.
And this is a very robust probe, as I recall, self-powered with an RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator. Am I correct in that? Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. We take the technology that we usually use way out at Jupiter and Saturn, and we're using it on Mars this time to allow us to have a power source that doesn't get affected by how much dust settles
right.
down the rover, or whether it's cold in the winter, for example.
And you know, Opportunity rover, Opportunity and Spirit. The big deal was they were supposed to land and last like 90 days or whatever, and here we are, how many years later?
Right. Yeah, 6 years later.
It's
actually, for us, working on the next rover, it's a little humbling because they keep setting the bar higher and higher, you know?
And curiosity, you have equal, I'm sure you have hopes, do you have expectations?
Yeah, we do. You know, a lot of what we're building is designed to last one full year on Mars, which is about 2 Earth years.
Mm-hmm.
And by, you know, JPL engineers, when they build something to last for 2 years, they really are building it to last a lot longer than that.
So yeah,
we hope it does, and that'll allow us to drive further and further and to process more of these precious samples.
Where do you get to land, and how far do you get to drive?
We're targeting these landing sites that give us access to the geology from the real distant past, and they're pretty exciting. We can land in more hazardous places, up close to more hazardous places. So I think this time when we land on Mars, we'll see mountains on the horizon, and we'll drive through canyons, and should be pretty spectacular relative to what we've done before.
Is this a landing bag type bouncing entry and hit, or is this a soft landing with rockets?
This is a soft landing with rockets. We've had to go back to that from the airbags just because of the size of this vehicle.
More like a Viking kind of thing.
It's more like a Viking, although the rover actually lands wheels on the ground, powered by a rocket jetpack that sets it down on the ground.
You're kidding! It lands, so it's not like it lands on a shell and then it drives off. It's the wheels basically touch down.
Yeah. It actually wears a little rocket jetpack for the last couple miles of descent, and then at the height of maybe a couple story building, that backpack lowers the rover down on some cables and sets it down on its wheels. The cables are cut, and it flies away. And then the rover's left ready to drive.
Oh, that's – if you don't throw out a camera, you know, 100 yards before you touch down and parachute and get an aerial view of this, that would be a crime. Wow, that would be really cool to watch.
It would. I'd love to be standing there on Mars watching it land.
Can you believe it? Well, look, Ashwin, we're going to take a final break here, and then we're going to come back with you for just a couple more minutes and make up some time here. In the meantime, want to let you know that everyone can still call in if you have a last-minute question. We will be back with a moment more about Mars exploration and a few other words about things coming up here in the next week as we take our final break. This is Space Talk brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB.
It's the little old lady from Pasadena.
This is Space Talk with Jim Banky.
The little old lady from Pasadena.
You know, you've got the best engineer in the world here working the boards. Aaron Michaels coming through with a little humor on a Halloween weekend here on as we begin our final segment of today's Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. By the way, Space Talk also brought to you today by our good friends at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, where for a limited time, all Florida residents who purchase one adult admission at regular price can bring in a friend or a loved one absolutely free. Strap yourselves into the shuttle launch experience, take a tour behind the scenes, walk beneath a massive moon rocket. You can even meet a real astronaut in person. It all adds up to a day of fun and a lifetime of inspiration. Get your coupon online for that deal at kennedyspacecenter.com and then launch yourself to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. But please do hurry. The special offer is only valid through December 18th. Well, we're talking Mars a little bit here again on a Halloween weekend. No war of the worlds going on yet. So far, Mars pretty quiet in its ability to defend itself as we continue to send our probes that way, and I think that's the right thing to do. Ashwin Vazavada from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, is on the phone with us for a couple more moments. And Ashwin, as we talk about the Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity is the name it's been given. What's ahead for you now? I believe your launch is, what, next November, a year from now?
That's right. It's the day after Thanksgiving next year is when the launch window opens. And we'll, you know, the Jet Propulsion Lab will be invading the Space Coast to watch that all happen.
That'll be great. What's in store between now? What's left to do between now and then? What kind of a timeline are you on, and how are you doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really picked up lately. For the first time ever, the rover exists as a complete vehicle. In the past month or so, it all came together, and we've been driving it around and testing it and testing all the software and the hardware. That goes on for another 8 months or so, and then we ship it all to Florida and do a lot more testing at the Cape.
Right.
And things are going pretty well. We actually delayed the project a couple of years ago. We missed our previous launch date.
Right.
But that, you know, that turns out to be a good thing, of course. We're a lot more prepared this time around, and really looking forward to getting it up next November.
What's it flying on?
It's on an Atlas V.
With a lot of extra solids on it, a heavy vehicle, or
yeah, it's got four solids.
Okay, that's respectable.
Yeah, and then an upper stage, and then it gets to Mars, and the rover that lands is still 1,000 kilograms, so 2,000 pounds. So this is a big vehicle. And once it gets to Mars, we launch at I think it's around 4,000 pounds at launch.
We talk about Mars, and if you heard some of the discussion today about things that can still go wrong, we know that Mars historically has been a 50-50 proposition, although as of late it seems to be getting better in our favor. I know that you're worried about that always until you're safely on the ground. Everyone feeling pretty confident, I would imagine, that maybe you figured this all out finally?
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever want to feel that confident. like you said, you know, diligence. But, you know, we have a Mars program, which is one of the great things that NASA's done in the last couple decades, where it's a continuous program of sending orbiters and landers at every opportunity when the planets allow us to do that,
right.
Line up and let us do that. And we learn from our mistakes and keep pushing the technology forward.
And how flexible can you be between now and next year? You know, I mean, even just this week, I think at least two releases came out about Mars and continued scientific findings about water and this or that of one thing or another. You know, is your science I know you're approaching your science a little bit differently, looking to the past, but are you able to or do you have to adjust your science program based on what may yet even be discovered in the next year?
Yeah, we designed this mission to be able to choose a landing site very late, and in fact we're not even choosing our landing site till next year. That allows us to respond to late-breaking discoveries. And also, you know, after we had designed all of our experiments, it was discovered that there's methane in Mars' atmosphere today, which could be a sign of life even today.
Yeah.
And fortunately, one of our experiments, we were flying for other reasons, has the ability to look at that. So we can pick that one up, even though we didn't plan for it.
And when you land, I want to go back to the landing site selection. When you land, one of the things that I've gotten to know a little bit about is some of this hypersonic reentry and some efforts to be able to try to develop a system that allows you to land at higher altitudes, I guess would be the way to say it, by taking advantage of aerobraking and other technologies. Do you still need to land fairly low with this spacecraft so that you have the most atmosphere to enter through?
Yeah, we've gotten a little better. We actually have what's called a guided entry, where we fly horizontally through the atmosphere for an extended period of time, and that allows us to burn off more speed in the atmosphere and then get to higher elevations. But we're still limited to about Mars, what we call sea level, even though there's no ocean.
Right.
And there's a lot more of Mars above Mars sea level that that we don't have quite the technology to get to yet.
And just a real quick answer, in best case, how far do you think you can drive from the landing spot? What's the farthest you might, or the total distance you think you might travel?
We're hoping to go about 10 or 15 miles in the 2 years.
Oh, that's incredible. Just incredible. Well, look, we're going to run out of time with you for today. Ashwin, this has just been fascinating stuff, and we're going to want to talk to you again as we get closer to the launch and we get this thing assembled and ready to go. Maybe when you get here for your TDY, we can have you in the show and here in the studio and get everyone excited about what's going to happen next Thanksgiving. Continued best wishes and good luck with your final preparations, and thanks for being on the show today.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Great. Dr. Ashwin Vizavada, Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, getting ready to send us back to Mars 1 year from now. The countdown is on. Well, speaking of countdowns, as we move forward here, we discussed at the beginning of the program, just to remind everyone, Discovery Now scheduled to launch this Wednesday at 3:52 p.m. Eastern Time. The weather looks fairly optimistic with a 70% chance of acceptable conditions. Our live coverage of Discovery's final launch and mission to the International Space Station will begin after the news at 3 p.m. on Wednesday, and we'll take you all the way through launch and arrival in orbit. Looking ahead for the rest of the month, the Delta IV Heavy, now at pad 37, is targeted to fly on November 15th, and SpaceX's second launch of the Falcon 9, now targeted for November 18th. So those dates continue to move around a little bit. We'll continue to follow them for you. In the meantime, I want to remind you to watch out for each other as you drive around town this weekend. The air show along Cocoa Beach is already underway. Today, the Air Force Thunderbirds will be beginning their show shortly again if they've everything stayed on schedule out there. So please watch the road if you're not if you're driving and don't watch the air show. The same holds true for tomorrow. As we continue to see everyone crowd along A1A on the beach, and then, of course, as the sun sets, be careful for the kids out trick-or-treating in the neighborhoods. I'll be at my front door dressed, as always, as Fred Flintstone, and hopefully have a smile on my face if the Vikings do beat the Patriots. It's a late afternoon game and a scary, scary deal for me for Halloween. Next week on Space Talk, we're going to have John Glisch from the Florida Today, Tracy Yates from the United Space Alliance. They're the winners of the Harry Colcomb News Award. We'll get into that next week. And I think that's about it for today. So thanks again for listening. Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida, production of Mila Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my chief engineer. And now stay tuned for, I guess, pregame show covering today's UCF football game with the East Carolina Pirates right here on WMMB. Don't miss it. I'm Jim Behnke. We'll talk to you again real soon.